Welcome to this continuing medical education audio podcast entitled Rapid Fire Review of AIDS 2018 that provides a quick audio summary of the most essential data presented at AIDS 2018. This independent CME activity is jointly provided by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and Viral-Ed, Inc. Support for this program has been provided by an independent educational grant from Gilead Sciences Medical Affairs. This program is produced by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and Viral-Ed, Inc. It is not a session created by or presented at AIDS 2018, and it is not sanctioned by the organizers of AIDS 2018. After completing this activity, the participant should be able to review data reported at AIDS 2018 for counseling, testing, and antiretroviral treatment to prevent HIV infection, especially in underserved communities. Relate, in a clinical setting, findings from key studies on HIV-AIDS diagnosis, management, and treatment presented at AIDS 2018. Employ strategies based on studies and data presented at AIDS 2018 for helping HIV-positive patients in medically underserved communities link to and stay in appropriate and effective HIV care. Discuss with patients and colleagues the studies and data on therapies for HIV/AIDS presented at AIDS 2018 and use that discussion to decide on appropriate planning of therapy for patients with HIV/AIDS. Our distinguished faculty for this program includes Drs. Ian Frank from the University of Pennsylvania, Jürgen Rockstra from the University of Bonn, Jose Arribas from the Hospital de la Paz, Graham Moyle from Chelsea and Westminster Hospital, Paul Sachs from Harvard Medical School, and Renslow Scherer from the University of Chicago. The Postgraduate Institute for Medicine requires all faculty participating in this activity to disclose any real or apparent conflict of interest they may have as related to the content of this activity. All faculty disclosures can be reviewed on the homepage of this program. In support of improving patient care, this activity has been planned and implemented by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and Viral-Ed, Inc. Postgraduate Institute for Medicine is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, ACCME, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, ACPE, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center, ANCC, to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. Please refer to the program homepage for information on the specific amount of AMA PRA Category 1 credits offered for this activity. Thank you for your time. The program will now begin.
Hello, this is Ian Frank from the University of Pennsylvania. I'm going to share some data with you on prevention and cure from the International AIDS Conference here in Amsterdam. First, I'll say a few words about the HIV epidemic. Some updates from the UN AIDS report. There are about 37 million people living with HIV infection in the world today, 21.7 million on antiretroviral therapy, 1.8 million new cases in 2017, and these are the most recently available data. If you look at the trends in the HIV incidence around the world, what you see is a remarkable reduction in sub-Saharan Africa. There's about a 40 to 45% reduction in new cases of HIV if you look at the time from 1996 with the peak of new cases until 2017. However, in the rest of the world, there's really a flat line. We haven't seen any decline in the number of new cases of HIV from about 2000 to 2017 with about 500,000 new cases a year. And the goal is only 500,000 cases worldwide by 2012. To accomplish that, we're going to need to get about 10 million new people on antiretroviral therapy in the next few years. And if you want to try to understand why that's the case, why we haven't seen a decline in new cases in many parts of the world, if you look at Europe, what you see is that in Western Europe, you have over 90% of the HIV-infected population tested and diagnosed and linked to care, and about 90% of those individuals on antiretroviral therapy. But in Eastern Europe, you see far fewer individuals on treatment with virologic suppression. So there are some parts of the world that are really lagging behind in treatment. So let me share some data with you on treatment as prevention, and then we'll talk about PrEP. There was an important study, the PARTNERS 2 study, a study of HIV-infected discordant couples. We saw data from the PARTNERS 1 trial that followed heterosexuals and gay men, discordant couples, that had been reported on previously with no cases of HIV linked transmissions that occurred in that initial report. The purpose of this follow-up study was to focus on discordant MSM couples to see how accurate those estimates are that there will be nobody who will acquire HIV. So they enrolled 972 gay couples. The infected partner had a viral load less than 200 copies. The uninfected partner was not on PrEP. And there were 15 new infections in the uninfected group in the follow-up period, but none of them were linked based upon the genotypic sequences. And with approximately 70,000 cases of condomless sex that were reported, no infections. And that includes 20,000 condomless sex acts with receptive anal sex with ejaculation, and over 6,000 condomless sex acts when one of the two partners had a sexually transmitted infection. So I think it's quite clear that if an individual has an undetectable viral load, the chances of them transmitting their infection to an uninfected individual is essentially zero. So how does treatment as prevention work in a community context? There was an important presentation from Botswana where they randomized 30 communities to either an aggressive treatment intervention or standard of care. The major difference here was in the more aggressive testing, linkage to care, maintenance and care efforts, and a initiation of antiretroviral therapy at higher CD4 counts, basically above 350, whereas the control group started therapy down below 350. And then in 2016, the country changed its guidelines to treat everybody, and then everybody in the standard as well as the intervention group got treated. And the purpose of the study was to see whether or not you'd reduce the number of new cases of HIV, and that happened. The annualized incidence was about 0.6% in the intervention group, 0.92% in the control arm, so about a 30 to 35% reduction in HIV incidence with more aggressive therapy. This is an important trial because it's the first randomized study to show that treatment as prevention really does work. If we go across the Atlantic to San Francisco, San Francisco has developed a very aggressive treatment program. And if you look at the years 2008 and the trends over time, we have a lot more people on antiretroviral therapy with virologic suppression. If you focus on the period of time 12 months after diagnosis, only 32% of the population in 2016 has a viral load greater than 200 copies, whereas in 2008, 70% of the population 12 months after diagnosis, you saw viral loads greater than 200 copies. And the number of new infections has declined by over 50%, with only 233 diagnosed HIV cases in 2016 compared to 523 in 2008. So treatment as prevention works. Let's talk about PrEP for a moment. There was some data presented on the rollout of PrEP in adolescent populations in the United States. And in 2017, there were over 7,600 individuals less than age 25 that were started on PrEP. That compares with 39,000 individuals started on PrEP over the age of 25 in the U.S. Interestingly, there's a small but significant proportion of patients that get started on PrEP in emergency departments, which is good in that the emergency department providers are thinking about HIV risk when they're seeing patients in that setting. But it's bad because they typically only get 1 month of PrEP and are unlikely to be continued. This is an important population. 21% of new cases of HIV are happening in adolescents in the U.S., and we need more of them on PrEP. Internationally, PrEP is being rolled out. There was data that was presented in 36 PEPFAR-funded countries showing that in the fourth quarter of 2017, there were over 7,000 individuals started on PrEP. So we're seeing more aggressive PrEP implementation programs really around the world. And this is really important because there is perhaps some evidence now that PrEP use decreases the risk of HIV acquisition. And I say this because of some data that was presented in a study led by Patrick Sullivan from Emory University and the CDC. He looked at PrEP implementation in the United States and divided the proportion of individuals who are on PrEP into quintiles, the 10 states with the lowest number of individuals on PrEP and then the 10 states with the highest proportion of individuals on PrEP. In the 10 states with lowest PrEP use, there was basically no change in incidence, while in the states with the highest PrEP utilization, although the rates of new cases of HIV were higher in the 10 states with highest PrEP use, the trend was clearly down, with about a 30% reduction in cases from 2012 to 2016 when PrEP implementation became more aggressive. Now, you may say maybe there are other factors. Maybe in these 10 states with the highest PrEP utilization, there's more treatment. But what they did was they analyzed the proportion of individuals in these various quintiles of states, the proportion on antiretroviral therapy, and the proportion with virologic suppression, and then controlling for the rate of virologic suppression. What they saw was in the two quintiles with the lowest PrEP utilization rate, a slight increase in the number of new cases of HIV, whereas in the quintile with the highest PrEP utilization, there was a 4.6% decline in HIV incidence. So maybe some epidemiologic evidence supporting the notion that PrEP does decrease the rate of HIV acquisition in a community. Let's go back to Europe now. Jean-Michel Molina presented some data from the ANRS Prévenir study. Prévenir is the French word for prevention. And this is an observational cohort, 3,000 Parisian MSM predominantly, who are educated about PrEP and are recommended to either take PrEP daily or to take it on demand. Tenofovir FTC before sex, one the following day, one the day after that. And the goal of this particular observational study is to be able to document a 15% decline in new HIV diagnosis among MSM in Paris. So in this interim analysis, there were no cases of HIV acquisition that occurred in about 950 person years of observation. And based upon the initial Ypres-Gay study, they would have predicted 85 transmissions. So PrEP seems to be effective in this observational context. There was an important presentation that was covered in the press, and I think the interpretation of this presentation was a little bit inaccurate, so I do want to mention this. This was a study that examined the pharmacokinetics of tenofovir in transgender women that were on feminizing hormone therapy. So a formal PK analysis was done in trans women who started on estradiol and sepropterone. And what was observed was a 13% decline in the trans women while on feminizing hormone therapy. That is not a significant reduction in tenofovir levels. It was actually below the coefficient of variation that was seen with respect to tenofovir concentrations in individuals on or off PrEP. And in the press, there's been a caution that has been extended, perhaps implying that PrEP will not be effective in trans women. And I don't think that that's really the case. We need more data in this population, but I don't think we should be withholding PrEP to trans women. The FDA doesn't recommend any dose modification of any medication unless there's a 30% or more altered dose in a population or relative to a drug-drug interaction. So I don't think we should be worrying about tenofovir levels in our trans women. Let me say a couple of words about CURE, because there was a study that people have really been waiting to see. And this is a study of an antibody, a monoclonal antibody, against an integrin called alpha-4 beta-7. This is a molecule that is on CD4 T cells, and high levels of this molecule result in homing of these particular CD4 cells to the gastrointestinal lymph tissue. And these cells are more likely to be infected than cells that have lower levels of alpha 4 beta 7. There was an important study that was presented a couple of years ago, published in the journal Science, that suggested that monkeys that were infected with SIV, that were put on antiretroviral therapy, had this monoclonal antibody added, and then went through interruptions first in their antiretroviral therapy and then stopped the infusions of this monoclonal, monkeys that had these interventions controlled their SIV infections, whereas monkeys that got a control IgG had a high virologic rebound to their previous treatment set point. A confirmation study was done in a different colony of rhesus macaques, and that study failed to confirm their initial observations. Animals that stopped their therapy had the same time to virologic rebound and the same viral load set points as animals that got a controlled antibody. And a phase one study reporting the effects of vedolizumab, a monoclonal antibody that's used to treat Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis that targets alpha-4 beta-7, a study done in humans that was modeled after the study done in the macaques did not show any benefit in terms of time to virologic rebound compared to a historical trial. So unfortunately, a little sobering news on the cure front. We're still a long way away from having an effective cure strategies, but the work continues. Thank you very much.
So this is Jose Rivas reporting from Amsterdam, the International AIDS Society meeting. I'm going to comment on the most important studies on antiretroviral naive patients. But before I do that, let me tell you that during this week, two important guidelines have been updated. One is the IAS guidelines. In terms of antiretroviral recommendations, now only three regimens are recommended: bictegravir, TAF FTC, dolutegravir, abacavir 3TC, and dolutegravir with TAF and FTC. Regimens with boosters are recommended when these three regimens cannot be used. And also raltegravir, because it's given BID, has a lower genetic barrier than bictegravir and dolutegravir, is recommended as an alternative. Also, efavirenz, rilpivirine, and darunavir boosted is considered an alternative regimen. Also, the WHO has updated his recommendations, and now dolutegravir is the preferred third drug along with two nucleosides over efavirenz. So we're seeing in the world a big rollout from efavirenz-based regimens to dolutegravir-based regimen. And we saw an interesting study from Brazil in which more than 100,000 patients with HIV were started on antiretroviral therapy. They look at the probability of being undetectable at month 6, and they found that participants treated with TDF-3TC dolutegravir have a higher chance of becoming undetectable than participants treated with other regimens such as efavirenz or boosted PIs. So, supporting with real life data what guidelines are recommended right now, that is to use integrase inhibitor regimens. All guidelines recommend triple therapy with two nucleosides and a third drug. There has been active research looking for regimens with less than three drugs in antiretroviral naive patients, and at this meeting, we've seen the results of two very important trials, the Gemini trials that enrolled more than 1,400 participants that were antiretroviral naive, that didn't have chronic hepatitis B, and have viral loads below 500,000 copies per ml, and they were randomized to receive dual therapy just with dolutegravir and 3TC, or triple therapy with dolutegravir, TDF, and FTC. The median viral load baseline was 4.4 logs, and the median CD4 cell count was 430. Only a minority of the participants have CD4 cell counts below 200. The dual therapy arm, by a snapshot analysis at 40 weeks, met non-inferiority criteria. The overall rates of suppressions were very high, where 93% of the participants randomized to triple therapy were below 50 at 40 weeks, compared to 90% of participants randomized to dual therapy. So in each particular study, non-inferiority was met, and also when the data were pooled, obviously non-inferiority was also met. Interestingly, the viral load, participants who have viral loads above 100,000 copies per ml did equally well on dual therapy or on triple therapy. And this is an important finding, because in prior studies of reduced drug regimens, a high viral load was an important determinant of efficacy. And in those patients where dual therapy tended to underperform. They made a similar analysis in participants with less than 200 CD4s, and they found that the difference in efficacy was in favor of triple therapy. 93% of participants on triple therapy with less than 200 CD4s were undetectable, compared to 79% in participants in dual therapy. This analysis has two caveats. First, it's small numbers. Only 55 participants in triple therapy and 63 in dual therapy were below 200. And the other caveat is that some of this difference is not related to treatment-related factors. There are discontinuations due to losses of withdrawal or withdrawal of consent. If we look at purely virological endpoints, there were just 4 in dual therapy and 1 in triple therapy. So I think we need to see more data in this particular population to make sure that dual therapy is a good option in patients with very advanced disease. One of the most important findings of the Gemini trial was that there was not a single case of virologic failure with development of resistance. There were no resistance to nucleosides and no resistance to integrase inhibitors. We saw also an interesting study in the States using the single pill combination recently approved of darunavir, cobicistat, FTC, and tenofovir alafenamide. And in the setting, this is a single arm clinical trial that enrolled participants who have been recently diagnosed and were offered treatment almost very soon after diagnosis. The clinicians couldn't see their labs, their baseline labs, after 3 days after initiation of treatment, and couldn't see resistant results after 1 month after starting treatment. And it's very interesting, because the majority of the participants became undetectable at week 24, and it was not needed to stop the regimen when the baseline data were seen. There were just 5 patients with high transaminases that were not related to chronic hepatitis, in whom they have to stop the regimen. But in retrospect, probably the regimen could have been continued, because we tend to see that these high transaminases not related to hepatitis tend to normalize with treatment. And not a single participant had to stop because of baseline resistance. Thank you.
Hi, this is Dr. Paul Sachs from Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School, and I'm here at the International AIDS Conference in Amsterdam, and I'm going to review the top stories that involve treatment-experienced patients that were presented at the meeting. Let me start by giving an update on the SWORD study. The SWORD study was a study of dolutegravir plus rilpivirine for maintenance of virologic suppression. The 96-week data were presented. We already know for the 48-week data that compared continued antiretroviral therapy with dolutegravir rilpivirine found that the two were both very good at maintaining virologic suppression, 95% success rates. Now we get to see the 96-week results, And at the 48-week mark, we had everyone switch over to the dolutegravir rilpivirine arm. At 96 weeks, the patients who originally had switched over to dolutegravir rilpivirine had an 89% response rate versus 93% in the people who switched late. So this demonstrates good maintenance of virologic suppression for the strategy. There were a low number of confirmed virologic withdrawals. That's what the study called it. These were virologic failures across the study population, with only 1%, 10 out of 990. 8 of these were on dolutegravir rilpivirine. Remember that this is not a comparative trial any longer. Taking a look at those patients who experienced virologic failure, we see something very interesting. 3 of them had development of rilpivirine resistance. 2 out of the 3, it was de novo rilpivirine resistance. 1 out of the 3, there actually was, looking at their baseline samples, they had resistance to NNRTIs at the outset, so this was not new resistance. Importantly, none of the study subjects developed resistance to dolutegravir. As a result, even though there is maybe a very small resistance risk from this strategy, it does not carry a sort of devastating effect on the subsequent regimens. Conceivably, all of these patients could then be switched to a standard dolutegravir or bictegravir-based fully suppressive regimen after virologic failure with resistance to rilpivirine. Another study looked at the 184V mutation, patients with the 184V mutation who are virologically suppressed, and asked the question of whether they can maintain virologic suppression on elvitegravir, cobicistat, FTC, and TAF. So 37 patients were enrolled. All of them switched over to this single pill regimen, and they intended to enroll 50, but it turned out to be difficult to find patients who historically only had the 184V mutation. At week 24, all maintained virologic suppression. There were no virologic rebounds. I think this is reassuring for patients who have a historical 184V that they can switch to an integrase-based regimen. I'm not sure I would use this particular one any longer. I would probably use a second-generation integrase inhibitor such as dolutegravir or bictegravir, but it does provide some reassurance. Another interesting thing about this study was that they did the GenoSure archive test on the patients at baseline, and interestingly, even though they all had 184V historically, only about 50% of them had this picked up using this test, demonstrating that this test, while specific, if it's not maybe 100% sensitive for historical resistance mutations. There were a couple of studies on dolutegravir monotherapy, and I want to emphasize before summarizing them that this is not a strategy that's recommended, but we probably did learn something additional. In this study of patients with treated during acute HIV infection, 100 patients, they were chosen because patients treated during acute infection may have a lower viral reservoir. So the idea was that maybe this is a special study subject population that could get by with a simpler monotherapy. They were randomized to receive dolutegravir monotherapy or to continue what they were on. I think importantly, the patients on monotherapy also got very intensively followed. There was an imbalance in how much they were monitored, which might have influenced the results. Out at week 48, there actually were similar virologic suppression rates in the people who were enrolled in the protocol. There was a patient who enrolled in the protocol who actually had chronic HIV infection and a higher HIV reservoir, and that individual ended up virologically failing. I think what the results are telling us is that there might be a study subject population that has a low reservoir who could conceivably maintain suppression on a simplified regimen. But since we don't really have a way of assessing this in clinical practice, we cannot recommend this particular strategy. The fact that we can't recommend the strategy was further emphasized by a second randomized trial called MONCAY, M-O-N-C-A-Y. This took stable patients on abacavir, lamivudine, dolutegravir, 158 of them, randomized them to continue that regimen or to switch to dolutegravir monotherapy. And while the results at week 24 demonstrated non-inferiority using a 12% virologic failure threshold, after week 24, there was an excess virologic failure numbers in the dolutegravir arm, so much so that the Data Safety Monitoring Board recommended termination of the study. In addition, out of these 7 patients who had virologic rebound, 2 of them developed resistance to dolutegravir, 147G and 155H in one subject and 263K in the other subject. So clearly, this is now at least the third study we've seen where dolutegravir monotherapy is not as effective as continued combination therapy, and we cannot recommend it. We did see updated data on the Dawning trial. This is a treatment study for patients failing their first 2-nuke and plus 1 non-nuke-based regimen, randomized to dolutegravir plus 2 nukes or lopinavir-ritonavir plus 2 nukes. At baseline, they had to have at least one active nucleoside by genotype testing. We already know at week 24 that the dolutegravir arm was superior, and as a result, the Data Safety Monitoring Board recommended stopping the comparison. However, most of the patients ended up continuing on to week 48. So now we see the primary results at week 48, and they really do demonstrate the superiority of the dolutegravir regimen, 84% suppressed versus 70% in dolutegravir, lopinavir, ritonavir, respectively. So this is highly statistically significant. It was true essentially for all baseline characteristics, with one exception being high viral load, although there were small numbers in that group. And we did see a couple of patients who experienced virologic failure on the dolutegravir arm who developed dolutegravir resistance. This is such a rare event that they were looked at a bit more closely. One of them started with a 70E mutation of tenofovir and 184V of emtricitabine or lamivudine, and this individual failed with a 118R mutation in integrase, which is unusual and does confer resistance to dolutegravir. And the second subject was just had 184V and 1-thymidine-associated mutation and also rebounded with the same mutation. I don't think this is common, and it doesn't sort of turn me away from the fact that dolutegravir plus 2 nucleosides is a better strategy than lopinavir-ritonavir plus 2 nucleosides. But I think it means that we should follow our patients who are treatment experienced on dolutegravir plus 2 nukes a bit more carefully, because they may develop resistance even if they have regimens that should be suppressive. So just a slightly cautionary note to those otherwise excellent Dawning study results. There is some updated information from the BRIGHT study of fostemsavir in highly treatment-experienced patients. There's an entry inhibitor that is still investigational. In these patients, many of whom had very few active drugs, it did achieve good results, showing that, you know, in the randomized comparison, it was about 60% virologic suppression, and the non-randomized about 40 to 50%. The non-randomized comparison, the patients actually had no active drugs in their background regimen. And the new information from this meeting was that baseline characteristics that we've seen before as predictive of outcome in treatment experience studies were very important here too. Patients with a viral load greater than 100,000 and patients with CD4 cell counts less than 50 were much more likely to have treatment failure despite the fostemsavir than patients in the other categories. Fostemsavir is a very promising agent for this very difficult to treat population and is still investigational. A couple of last things to mention. One is that patients in the doravirine treatment naive studies, they often developed resistance. When they developed resistance, which was rare, they developed V106I and F227C. These mutations confirmed, especially F227C, confirmed what is known as hypersusceptibility to MK8591, the investigational long-acting NRTI, or nucleoside reverse transcription translocation inhibitor. Why is that important? Well, doravirine is being combined with MK8591 in clinical trials right now in phase 2. Another study to mention is that patients who have resistance to integrase inhibitors were looked at whether the second-generation integrase inhibitors, dolutegravir, bictegravir, and cabotegravir, had much in the way of differential effect as terms of activity against resistant virus, in particular 140 and 148 positions. The answer is, unfortunately, no. There is an extensive cross-resistance between dolutegravir, bictegravir, and cabotegravir, suggesting that, you know, virologic failure with resistance to one is unlikely to be salvaged with the other. So to summarize some key points, dolutegravir and rilpivirine maintains virologic suppression at 96 weeks. There were a couple of few patients who developed rilpivirine resistance, not surprisingly, in a study of 1,000 individuals. But overall, the dolutegravir is still active with no integrase resistance. We still don't recommend dolutegravir monotherapy. And second-line treatment with after failure of 2 nukes plus a non-nuke, dolutegravir is superior to lopinavir-ritonavir and clearly is the treatment of choice, but one should watch out potentially for some virologic failure with resistance in certain rare individuals. And then last, fostemsavir looks very effective in highly treatment-experienced patients, and responses are better if salvage therapy is started earlier. Thank you very much for listening.
Hello, my name's Graham Moyle from the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital in London in the UK. I'm going to talk today about adverse events and metabolism issues that were described during the World AIDS Conference here in Amsterdam. The first report I wanted to talk about came out in the New England Journal of Medicine to coincide with this conference, which was the concern raised about the use of dolutegravir at the time of conception and the possibility of development of neural tube defects. This report arose from four women who'd been receiving dolutegravir at the time of conception in Botswana, who had infants with neural tube defects, out of 426 women exposed in this way to dolutegravir. The group in Botswana who reported this are going to expand their cohort and estimate that they'll have approximately three times the number of exposures at the time of conception by March 2019 to see whether they can confirm or refute this report. It's important to note that the pregnancy registries that exist at the present time that have generally reported the good safety of antiretroviral therapy do not detail whether women exposed in the first trimester have been exposed at the time of conception. The neural tube closes by approximately 28 days after conception, and that therefore to detect abnormalities that are related to drug exposure, the drug exposure needs to occur within this window. If we compare the rates observed in the 4 out of 426 women who had children with neural tube defects with groups exposed to other antiretroviral treatment or who started dolutegravir after day 28 into pregnancy compared with those who received conception, the rates are 0.84 for dolutegravir at conception versus 0.12 for other antiretroviral therapy and 0 for dolutegravir started after pregnancy. The background rate in the Botswana population is approximately 0.09, suggesting there is about a tenfold higher rate of neural tube defect in women exposed to dolutegravir at conception if these rates continue to be observed. The group reported during the conference further follow-up with an additional 10 weeks of follow-up, during which time they observed one infant exposed to dolutegravir during pregnancy, 8 weeks after conception, who had a neural tube defect, which, given the timing of closing of the neural tube, suggests it is not related, and one in an HIV-uninfected individual. They provided estimates of what needs to be seen to either confirm or refute this observation once they have 1,226 births with exposure to dolutegravir at conception by March 2019. If no further events are observed, the statistical significance will begin to overlap with efavirenz and with HIV-uninfected individuals. And if one further case is observed, the rates will overlap with other regimens, but not with the general population figures. If more than two further cases are observed in the approximately 800 ongoing pregnancies, then this would confirm the report and suggest that there is a true relationship between dolutegravir at conception and neural tube defects. For the time being, clinicians are counselling women of childbearing potential or childbearing intent around these data to look at the balance of risk versus benefit of prescribing dolutegravir. As you will hear in other programs, a randomised controlled trial also conducted in sub-Saharan Africa looking at dolutegravir versus efavirenz in women who would already become pregnant showed some virological advantage to dolutegravir in these women. And of course, commencing dolutegravir after day 28 when the neural tube is closed is not a concern. So moving on to other issues that were reported during the conference, dolutegravir is becoming a widely prescribed drug, and the most common adverse event that has been reported in cohort studies with the drug relates to CNS disturbance, particularly insomnia. The group from ViiV reported a meta-analysis across the randomised controls of dolutegravir versus non-dolutegravir regimens for neuropsychiatric adverse events, including insomnia anxiety, depression, suicidality, nightmares or abnormal dreams, and headache. There was no significant increase in the risk of these events in individuals randomised to dolutegravir versus non-dolutegravir regimens, or indeed to regimens where abacavir was prescribed relative to non-abacavir regimens. The caution with interpreting these data is that the analysis included a large group of subjects participating in the single study who also received efavirenz, and that therefore were likely to be captured in this catch-all analysis of neuropsychiatric events where the efavirenz group was known to be associated with greater amounts of anxiety, depression and nightmares and abnormal dreams. Although in the single study, insomnia was numerically more common in people receiving dolutegravir relative to efavirenz. A French cohort study also looked at neuropsychiatric events across a large number of individuals exposed to the three main integrase inhibitors prior to the availability of bictegravir. Neuropsychiatric events were reported in about 3% of individuals receiving dolutegravir, with lower rates for elvitegravir, cobicistat, or for raltegravir. However, overall, any adverse event was similar between the two groups, with a trend towards any adverse event being less commonly reported in the dolutegravir group. Many individuals during the cohort study switched off raltegravir for reasons of treatment simplification, as it was twice daily dosed during the course of the study. They could not find a clear risk factor associated with neuropsychiatric events, although possible factors did include prior reporting of neuropsychiatric events, as well as the events being more common in individuals who were antiretroviral experienced. So we can think that CNS side effects may be observed with anybody starting antiretroviral therapy, but they may be more common with dolutegravir and relative to other INSTIs. Now, what about bictegravir? So bictegravir is an integrase inhibitor available in a single tablet co-formulation with FTC and TAF. It has been approved in the United States for a number of months and is just rolling out in Europe at the present time. Considerable interest exists whether bictegravir may have some tolerability advantages of dolutegravir. Data were reported from individuals in the 1489 looked at the single tablet FTC TAF bictegravir versus the single tablet of abacavir 3TC dolutegravir. So it doesn't quite address the issue of is there a difference between bictegravir and dolutegravir, but more is there a difference between the drugs with regards to the single tablet regimens in which they're available. The study looked at patient-reported outcomes where they had a symptom list of so-called bothersome symptoms as well as some sleep scales that were evaluated both in the treatment-naive period of the study and in the follow-up period where individuals switched away from dolutegravir over to bictegravir FTC TAF. In both periods of time, bothersome symptoms were reported less commonly in individuals receiving bictegravir FTC TAF relative to dolutegravir abacavir 3TC, and that this observed reduction in bothersome symptoms persisted in individuals who then were virologically suppressed in the follow-up study. The sorts of symptoms that were more commonly observed in dolutegravir abacavir 3TC recipients included fatigue, lightheadedness, nausea, loss of appetite, mood disorder, nervousness or anxiety, difficulty sleeping. So one of the big news at the conference was the Gemini 1 and 2 results. You'll remember from the podcast and symposium that Jose Arribas has presented that the results of the Gemini study comparing dolutegravir 3TC with dolutegravir tenofovir FTC over 48 weeks demonstrated no significant differences in efficacy between the two groups. In the safety analysis of this study, there were similar number of adverse events reported. Most notably, as one arm was receiving tenofovir DF and the other arm not, there was a reduction in the number of tenofovir-related side effects, such as changes in estimated GFR or the loss of low molecular weight protein in the urine, such as retinol-binding protein or beta-2 microglobulin. Similarly, as TDF-based regimens are known to increase bone turnover, these were also noted to be lower in the individuals receiving the dolutegravir 3TC regimen, similar to outcomes that have been reported when abacavir has been used as an alternative to tenofovir DF or tenofovir allafenamide has been used as an alternative. The SWORD study looked at switching in individuals who were most commonly on a tenofovir-based regimen over to the two-drug combination of dolutegravir-rilpivirine. And again, with this two-drug regimen as a switch alternative, individuals reported maintenance of virological control, although, of course, introducing two new drugs to the regimen did in some cases increase some clinical adverse events such as nausea, headaches and insomnia. As many of the patients were removing tenofovir from their regimen, three things were observed with regards to metabolic outcomes. These were firstly that bone turnover markers declined following the removal of tenofovir DF, again similar to TAF or abacavir switch studies, that the loss of retinol binding protein and other low molecular weight proteins was reduced, and finally there was a look at lipids, which were fairly neutral because, of course, while dolutegravir-rilpivirine may have limited impact on lipids, the removal of tenofovir DF from the regimen typically leads to small increases in total cholesterol. A study from Thailand, which is the largest one reported so far, looked at switching off efavirenz to rilpivirine in 246 individuals randomized to either continue or switch. This type of switch has been looked at previously in smaller numbers of individuals, and of note, Maggie Brackey from London reported last year that individuals who reported that they were feeling well or normal on efavirenz actually reported an improved sensorium after switching off efavirenz and generally preferred the new normal that they experienced on rilpivirine relative to efavirenz. Again, the switch off of efavirenz may have some metabolic advantages with improvements in triglycerides, total cholesterol and LDL cholesterol observed in this and other studies. And that similar to the UK study reported last year, patients who entered the study with baseline symptoms related to their central nervous system saw an abrogation of those symptoms when switched to rilpivirine versus a persistence if they continued on their efavirenz-based regimen. As we would no longer start individuals on an efavirenz-based regimen, and it is now no longer the WHO first-line recommended regimen, I think we should certainly be looking at our patients who are currently receiving efavirenz to see whether we can achieve metabolic advantages, which may include reductions in proathrogenic lipids, improvements in glucose or reductions in the risk of diabetes, as well as improvement in the sensorium when switching to this product. One area of interest in my practice is diabetes. We have approximately 10% of our patients with HIV also having diabetes as a comorbidity. A study from Germany looked at the euglycemic clamp, gold standard methodology for evaluating glucose disposal in three regimens, one with FTC and TAF, one with elvitegravir, cobicistat, FTC and TAF, and finally with rilpivirine, FTC and TAF. TAF regimens have not previously been evaluated for their impact on glucose disposal. The outcomes of the study indicate that there are minimal or no substantial shifts in total body glucose disposal as a result of treatment modification or as a result of using TAF regimens over a 14-day period of time, underlining that these are highly attractive regimens to consider in individuals with metabolic disorders, insulin resistance or diabetes, where TAF has an advantage over abacavir with regards to cardiovascular risk and over TDF with regards to proteinuria and EGFR impact. Finally, when we can't have an HIV conference without a new disease associated with HIV infection being reported, and in this case it was long-term follow-up of individuals in the Kaiser Permanente cohorts located in California and the east coast of the United States. very large numbers of patients, over 38,000 individuals with HIV infection, matched to 10 times more HIV negative controls. And the outcome reported here was an increased risk in heart failure in individuals with HIV infection that was highly significant compared with the HIV negative group, with approximately a 5% cumulative incidence relative to about a 3.5% cumulative incidence with HIV in multiple models, adjusting for baseline risk factors being an independent risk factor, increasing the risk of heart failure by around 40% or more. One caveat with regards to this study was that many of the individuals within the study were exposed to older drugs as part of antiretroviral treatment or had prolonged periods of viremia at the time of entry into the cohort before starting on definitive antiretroviral treatment. And therefore, it will be interested in years to come to see whether these data can be updated to look at individuals who follow a more current test-and-treat approach. That being said, the cohort is very representative of our older populations that have had prolonged exposures to viremia and lower CD4 nadirs. So to conclude, some key points that have arisen that we should be looking for day-to-day tolerability issues with new treatment regimens to see how they compare with our older regimens, for things that bother patients and may affect their ability to sustain treatment in the long term. That there is evidence that if we remove TDF from regimens, either by using a two-drug regimen or by using alternatives such as TAF or abacavir, we can avoid those TDF-related renal or bone changes. And that changes from efavirenz to rilpivirine are associated with improved central nervous system and lipid outcomes, and we need to consider our patients who are currently on efavirenz as potentially for change. And finally, when we're looking at TAF as a preferred choice in individuals with metabolic disorders, we have now supportive evidence to show that either TAF-FTC or in combination with L-vitegravir, cobicistat or rilpivirine is not associated with insulin resistance. Thank you for your kind attention.
Hello, this is Jürgen Rockstroh reporting back from the IS conference here in Amsterdam, and I'm going to talk a little bit about new data around co-infections. Now, the first thing to say is that obviously hepatitis C treatment works very well, so there's very few data on new treatment paradigm for hepatitis C, as obviously with what we have, we can cure pretty much everyone. So there were really some other topics in the oral abstract session this time in Amsterdam. And there were really two studies which focused on a recent outbreak of acute hepatitis A in Taiwan. That occurred 2016-2017. There were over 1,500 indigenous hepatitis A cases reported. The majority, 70%, were in MSM. 60% also had a concomitant HIV infection. And it's fair to say that similar outbreaks have been reported in Europe, particularly in conjunction with larger MSM-driven Christopher Street Day events in Madrid and Amsterdam. Now, one of the studies focused on the natural course of hepatitis A in patients with HIV versus patients who have hepatitis A and are not HIV infected. And the interesting thing is that indeed the peak ALT and AST are much lower in HIV-infected versus non-HIV-infected patients with acute hepatitis A, and there also is a difference in the prolonged INR time. So the presentation may be different, but the time to clearance of viremic hepatitis A is also different and being longer in HIV-co-infected individuals. That means that you have a longer period before you clear infection, which means you will remain more infectious over a longer time period. So that's important also in counseling our patients, that they may transmit it to other people as well. Interestingly, when they did a sub-analysis looking at those who had well-controlled viremia, or at least the viral load below 1,000 copies, that then led to a shorter time point or duration of acute hepatitis A. So clearly, successful HIV therapy helps to return the course of hepatitis A and HIV-positive individuals back to those who are not infected. The second study from Taiwan focused on the results of hepatitis A vaccination, how protective that was. And then there was also a risk analysis comparing uninfected controls versus 55 cases. And clearly the first thing which came out of that was that single-dose hepatitis A vaccination was highly protective with 96.1%. two-dose vaccination, 97.8%, really re-emphasizing how important hepatitis A vaccination is to prevent the onset of acute hepatitis A. Interestingly, patients who had a syphilis within the last 6 months were more likely to have an hepatitis A infection, telling us that if you're sexually very active and have risk situations, you may also be more prone for that infection in lack of a vaccination. Interestingly, when you look at the modeling they did, they showed very nicely that if you have a strong uptake of vaccination programs, you can actually come to a reduction in your cases of hepatitis A quite dramatically. And that was really mirrored very nicely by the CDC vaccination program, which followed the outbreak, and the uptake of vaccination led to a good control of the outbreak in Taiwan. So the Dutch colleagues have published before a study showing a relatively high 4.8% prevalence of hepatitis C in their PrEP user cohort, really reminding us that we start have to look for hepatitis C and HIV negative MSM as well. In their PrEP study, they did very close monitoring hepatitis C and indeed were able to report 6 primary hepatitis C infections in their follow-up, leading to an incidence of primary infection of 1.0 per 100 person years and a very high reinfection rate of 25.5%. 25.5 per 100 person year, really reminding us all that hepatitis C remains an issue in patients on PrEP with high risk behavior. Phylogenetic analysis suggested that indeed there is a strong link between HIV negative and HIV positive MSM, so they're really in the same sexual network, and that's where the virus strains can be found. Now, obviously, next to hepatitis C, there's also a question, what is happening with sexually transmitted infections? And there was data from the ECDC, which was very interesting in showing that really everything which can be transmitted sexually, gonorrhea, syphilis, chlamydia, is pretty much on the uprise. Obviously, this is all before the introduction of PrEP, so please keep in mind that STIs are already increasing even before PrEP came around. And whereas HIV infections are declining, syphilis infections are increasing and for the first time had higher numbers than new HIV infections. If you look by transmission category, you can see that indeed, in particular, there is a rise in infections in MSM, a little bit in heterosexual men, and to a lesser extent also in women. So it's on the rise in every group, but clearly the highest and significantly in the MSM patient population. And the same holds true for gonorrhea cases, again, rising, particularly MSM group. Around TB, there was at least one study to report back from. That's the Inspiring, a study we already saw earlier this year at CROI, where the 24-week results are presented. Here we saw an update with 48 weeks result of the Phase 3B study comparing dolutegravir with the 50 milligram BID, so the adapted dose when you combine it with rifampicin, plus 2 nukes versus efavirenz, 600 milligram QD plus 2 nukes. And very much nicely in line with the 24-week results, the efficacy of the two regimens was comparable, 75 and 82% suppressed respectively, overall good tolerability, and I think most importantly for the clinicians, where there was this worry that a faster time to undetectability with an integrase inhibitor may impact iris rate, that did not play out at all. The iris rates were absolutely comparable. The treatment outcomes now after the longer follow-up look good. Around 90% treatment success for TB for both of the regimens used, and no deaths in this trial. So the last study I want to mention is really not a co-infection study, but a study which is looking more at liver disease and HIV in general. And this was a study from Brazil, which sort of aimed at comparing HIV mono-infected patients and the risk for developing liver steatosis versus patients from an adult health cohort, over 15,000, which is studied in Brazil. And these patients were matched to pairs based on demographic, metabolic, and inflammatory characteristics. Liver steatosis was assessed by fatty liver index. This is a serological marker not everyone will be familiar with, which is used to detect steatosis by using gamma GT, BMI, waist circumference, and triglycerides. The overall prevalence of steatosis was relatively high, with 35% in the HIV-infected patient population. But when you looked at the risk factors, really it was all the typical metabolic features you know, BMI, high waist circumference, development of diabetes, dyslipidemia, hypertension, metabolic syndrome, but also CD4 count and duration of treatment may seem to play a role. If you look at the factors independently associated with liver steatosis in the multivariate analysis in the HIV-infected patients, it was again BMI, diabetes, dyslipidemia, hypertension, but also CD4 count and cumulative HIV viral load. So suggesting that potentially HIV markers may also impact the development of liver steatosis. And when then that was put into a modeling and using a propensity score analysis, you could see that HIV-infected patients had a 2.1 higher risk of developing liver steatosis versus patients who do not have HIV. So when you then compare the presence of steatosis in HIV, non-HIV-infected individuals, paired by the nearest neighbor propensity score, then most interestingly, HIV infection emerged as an independent factor for developing liver steatosis. So this is really the first analysis which suggests that potentially HIV has an independent effect and has higher risk of developing liver steatosis in HIV patients. I think the limitation of the study is the method used, because biological or serological markers for fatty liver disease are not that well established. And the second limitation is that obviously some of the parameters which go into this risk index, in particular gamma GT, may be impacted by antiviral therapy. So the question remains, is someone on efavirenz or nevirapine, as a gamma GT as an increase as a function of the ARV, the same finding, yes or no? So there will be have to be sub-analysis depending on the underlying baseline antiviral therapy. Thank you very much.
This concludes our audio podcast entitled Rapid Fire Review of AIDS 2018, which has been brought to you from Amsterdam, Netherlands. This program was produced by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and Viral Ed, Inc. This coverage is not sanctioned by the conference organizers and is not an official part of the conference proceedings. To receive CME credit for completing this activity, please go to www.cmeuniversity.com, then click on Find Post-Test Evaluation by Course on the navigation menu, enter the CME code 13217, and complete the evaluation to receive your certificate. For more CME programming on CROI 2018, including an on-demand conference review internet symposium, including a version covering the EU perspective, and a post-conference CME dinner program series, please visit www.viraled.com. Thank you for your participation.